You're listening to the Cycling Podcast in association with Rafa, celebrating the sport and producing the finest cycling clothing since 2004.
Hello, my name's Richard Moore. I'm with Daniel Freeb.
Hello, Richard.
And Lionel Burney.
Hello, chaps.
Hello, fellas. We were together in Berlin last week. We're not today. We're in London, Lionel, aren't we? And you're in Berlin there, Daniel, looking good.
You can't see me. We can only see your hand.
We can only see your chest and your Gianni Savio coiffured microphone.
How's my chest looking? Ripped.
Well, it's covered by wool, a woolen jumper. It must be cold out there, is it? It was freezing last week. Has it warmed up a bit this week?
Warmed up about 10 degrees.
Excellent. This is really odd, isn't it? Yep. I mean, what? Daniel refuses to show his face on screen.
TV's Daniel Free, reluctant to appear in vision. I don't understand. But anyway,
we've got lots about to talk about, as per usual. Lionel, first of all, can we have the news roundup, please?
All eyes were on the Qatari desert and the World Championship road races this weekend. There was a bit of an upset in the women's road race as 20-year-old Danish rider Amalie Diederichsen pulled off a stunning sprint to beat the pre-race favourite Kirsten Wild of the Netherlands. Lotta Lepisto of Finland took the bronze medal. Lizzie Deignan put up a strong defence of her world title, finishing fourth, and she was the first to congratulate her Bols Dahlman's teammate as they crossed the line. Earlier, the race had been brought to life by a brave solo attack from America's Amber Nabhan, who was hoping to add the road race title to the time trial she won earlier in the week, but without help up the road, the odds were stacked against her. The men's race was shaped by crosswinds that caused major splits in the peloton with 184 kilometres to go. A lead group of 27 then raced towards the finishing circuits, putting everyone else out of contention. On the laps in Doha, though, it was tame stuff, with no major attacks to talk of, until Dutchman Tom Laser attacked with around 1.5 kilometres to go. It was a good effort by Laser, but he needed a miracle to hold off the sprinters. At the line, it was Peter Sagan who managed the magical combination of great positioning and speed to take the second world title in a row. The Slovakian repeated his victory from Richmond a year ago, and he joins Georges Ronsa of Belgium in 1928-29, Rick van Steenbergen in 1956 and 57, Rick van Looy in 60 and 61, Gianni Bugno in 1991 and 1992, and Paolo Bettini in 2006-2007 as the only riders to win back-to-back rainbow jerseys in the men's road race. Mark Cavendish was second, and he later said that he thought that that was his last chance to win a second world title on the road. Belgium's Tom Bonham was third, and that meant it was also the first time ever that three former world champions have taken the top three steps on the podium. Away from the racing, the route for the 2017 Tour de France has been unveiled. We'll discuss it in more detail later in the episode. We already knew the Grand Depart would be in Dusseldorf in Germany, with a 13-kilometre individual time trial kicking things off. But we now also know there'll be 9 flat stages, offering plenty of chances for the sprinters, and perhaps giving Cavendish a chance to get closer to Eddy Merckx's record of 34 stage wins. Cavendish is currently on 30. The tour will visit all 5 of France's mountain ranges. That's the Vosges, the Jura, the Pyrenees, the Massif Central and the Alps. It's the first time since 1992 that that's happened. There'll be 5 summit finishes, including the Planche des Belles Filles at the end of stage 5, which is pretty early in the race, and the Col d'Izoard in the Alps towards the end. There'll be a 23-kilometre time trial in Marseille on the penultimate day before a long transfer, well, for us anyway, the riders will all fly, up to Paris for the traditional Champs-Élysées finish. Contrary to reports last week in The Guardian, which I mentioned in the news roundup, La Course, the women's race, is not expanding to a multi-day event. Instead, it will be a 67-kilometre race finishing on the Izoard rather than the Criterium in Paris. The controversy surrounding Team Sky continues to rumble on following revelations that Bradley Wiggins had used a corticosteroid with a therapeutic use exemption before 3 Grand Tours, including the 2012 Tour, which he won. On Sunday, we broadcast our interview with Team Sky's boss, Dave Brailsford, which is still available to listen to, and we'll discuss the fallout from that later on in this episode. Next week, it's the London 6 Day at the Olympic Velodrome, where Mark Cavendish and Wiggins are due to team up. It's also been announced that this London 6 Day is part of a series of 6 Day races, including Amsterdam, Berlin and Copenhagen over the winter, and there'll be a final 1 Day event on the track at Palma Mallorca in March, with the inaugural Revolution Champions League of Cycling also kicking off in Paris next month and featuring several of the World Tour teams. This is an exciting time for track racing fans. So I know Daniel is particularly interested in all of this.
Thank you very much for that news roundup, Lionel. So in part one, we'll be talking about the World Championships. Part two, we'll discuss the route of the 2017 Tour de France. And in part three, we'll return, hopefully reasonably briefly, to our interview with Sir Dave Brailsford, which happened on Friday evening, in a hotel just north of London and was broadcast on Sunday morning. And that there's been obviously a lot of reaction to that, a lot of quite interesting emails that we've received from people, and it'd be interesting obviously to get Daniel's thoughts on that as well, because Lionel and I did the interview. Daniel armed us with some questions, but it'd be interesting to hear his views on it. Let's talk about the World Championships. We also received an email from a listener in Qatar, not too happy at our dismissal of Qatar as a venue for the World Championships. Made some valid points, maybe read out a bit of his email. But I think our main criticism was that there wouldn't be a lot of fans there, and that obviously proved to be the case. I also think I said last week that the racing could be thrilling, because it can be when the wind blows, and the wind did blow for the men's race on Sunday, and it was a thriller. Although Mark Cavendish, in an interview with Tom Kerry of The Telegraph today, said it would have been equally as exciting had it been 50 kilometres shorter.
Yeah, I think to call it a thriller is perhaps stretching it a bit. There was certainly an extremely interesting and very exciting phase of the race, lasted around 40 kilometres when the split happened, and then when everyone was trying to get back on terms, and unsuccessfully as it turned out, and just trying to work out who was in each group on the road, and watching the front group of favourites drilling it very hard, and then watching the chasers. And then really anticipating when the riders who'd been caught out would call it a day and realise that they weren't going to get back on terms. But then as it calmed down again and the gaps were set at around a couple of minutes, really then it settled into a pattern of really quite timid racing.
You like your patterns, don't you, Lionel?
Once they got to the circuits and the wind wasn't going to affect anything, that group of leaders, 27, I think it was, bear in mind there's probably four or five of them who were from the initial break, so they weren't going to do anything. The Belgians were very strong, the Italians were very strong, so they kind of had a stranglehold on it, really. And I said in last week's podcast, you know, the anticipation of having one of those kind of powerful looking moves going with, say, 50 kilometres to go, and you'd be looking at, say, Greg Van Avermaet, Nicky Terpstra, riders like that, trying to pull something off and go for a long one. But the reality was the racing had probably been so hard out in the desert that everyone was tired by the time they got there, and there were too many bodies from the Italians to chase, say, Van Avermaet, and too many Belgians to basically... The effect was that it discouraged everybody else. So really we then had a 50 kilometre wait for the sprint, and I was very surprised that even in the final 5 kilometres there was relatively little action, which I think, you know, is a consequence of the fact that they were lined out in single file for probably 100 kilometres.
184 kilometres, yeah. I think it was before, you know, left the race when that move went clear. And the British team were very prominent there with the Belgians. The French and the Germans missed out. What happened to the French and the Germans, Daniel?
Well, I think it was symptomatic of not really having they had a clear plan, but it sounded a pretty flimsy plan. Certainly in the French team's case, you know, they had this idea that they were going to split the team down the middle between Demar and Buhani, but they were going to ride together or for each other, or the two blocks of the team were going to ride for each other until the last few kilometres, when they were going to kind of split into respective, well, you know, it was a bit ambiguous whether they were actually going to have separate trains. They said they weren't, but then they also said each guy was going to have his usual lead out man. So it was obviously some plan to sort of divide towards the end. And I think, you know, they admitted themselves that when the key action happened and the split happened, they weren't united enough. And probably the same happened with the Germans. You know, they had Greipel, they had Kittel, they had Degenkolb. Kittel, who once again showed that he's not particularly at home in crosswinds. Of the best sprinters in the world, I think Christoph has shown on numerous occasions that he's very adept at riding crosswinds. Cavendish, I think, is one of the best riders in the world in that kind of condition. And Kittel perhaps is less comfortable. So they really fell apart, those two teams. And you know, the French director, Bernard Bureau, has said that it's going to be his last World Championships. He was pretty bitter afterwards. And it was a bit of a mess, wasn't it? You know, the British team were pretty unlucky that Rook Lowe, as I like to call him, Luke Rowe, punctured at a crucial moment. He really should have been in that split. He was in that split and punctured, so that effectively excluded him at that point. And it really reminded me of a conversation we had earlier in the year when, you know, we talked about numerical advantage in races like Sundays, when it actually ceases to be a numerical advantage in the end, because everyone looks to the team with the most riders, in this case Belgium, and over the next 100 kilometres or 150 kilometres, as was the case, they effectively have to erode their own numerical advantage because everyone looks at them. So therefore, they come into the finale with the same number of guys as everyone else, and that's pretty much what happened on Sunday. And, you know, Boonen said that if he'd had one more guy, then he thinks he would have won. You know, that's obviously speculation, which Lionel will balk at. But, their advantage wasn't as strong, wasn't as sort of emphatic as it might have looked when they had, you know, those six riders as against Great Britain's two and you know, other teams. So, you know, Australia only had one rider there or two riders there.
And ultimately didn't have a fast enough finisher in Bonin, did they? John Degenkolb rode a very aggressive race, didn't he?
Man of the match, really, because he was on the front of that second big group for a very
long time.
Well, yeah, but then he got very frustrated with one of the Belgians in that group, didn't he, and squirted water. Presumably,
I think he'll regret
just trying to hydrate.
I think he'll regret that. I mean, he was probably quite grateful for it, unless it was some sticky energy drink. But I've seen Degenkolb lose his temper before, and it's quite scary. He lost his temper a little bit with me in Bern at the Tour de France when I asked him a really stupid question, which I think I revealed on the podcast. But I've also seen him lose his temper at the end of the stage, the cobbled stage at Tour de France last year that was won by Tony Martin. Degenkolb, I think, was second, and he'd obviously won Paris-Roubaix that year. And he was furious. He was particularly angry with Warren Barguil, who he felt had sort of looked after himself a little bit in that group and not helped bring Martin back. And he really lost his temper. And joking apart, it wasn't great to see, was it? And he lost control of himself, and he's going to have to address that.
Hothead, isn't he? He's a hothead.
A little bit, yeah.
Well, literally, it was 40 degrees. I mean, they were all hotheads, weren't they? But
it's a very hot head.
Everybody else managed to keep it in check.
Just going back to the tactics in the finale, Rich, I mean, it did seem strange, or we perhaps expected Belgium to try something. You know, we didn't think they'd be comfortable going to a sprint with Cavendish and some of the other fast guys in that group. But, you know, I wondered whether Boonen had been slightly haunted and stung by his experience at Paris-Roubaix, where, you know, he went towards the velodrome with Matt Heyman and tried to attack a couple of times when you would have expected him to be the fastest guy in the sprint. And he probably paid for that effort in Paris-Roubaix. He wasn't as quick as he would normally have been in the sprint. And, it was interesting that he adopted, or he went for a different tactic here. I mean, the Belgians obviously had the option of Van Avermaet as well, but Van Avermaet really backed the wrong horse in latching onto Nicky Terpstra when he attacked sort of half-heartedly about 4 or 5 kilometres from the finish. And you imagine that if he'd gone with Tom Laser, who really put in the most meaningful attack in the finale and came quite close to winning, if Van Avermaet had got onto his wheel, then perhaps that would have been a good option for the Belgians.
But then you wonder if the most meaningful attack by Tom Laser was the most meaningful, because it was Tom Laser, and a guy who, you know, had it been Terpstra or Van Avermaet, he wouldn't have been perhaps let go quite so easily. I think everyone was dead on their legs, weren't they? And I mean, we have to talk about Peter Sagan and Mark Cavendish, I think, who you know, Cavendish knew exactly what to do. He was glued to Sagan's back wheel. And that meant that when Adam Blythe jumped, he didn't follow him. And perhaps, you know, had he done so, the outcome would have been different. Watching the sprint again overhead, I mean, Sagan's, we know all about his bike handling ability, but it was a bit like the cycling equivalent of Diego Maradona's second goal against England. He sort of weaved through several bodies. As a Scotsman, I prefer Diego Maradona's first goal against England in that 1986.
I would have thought you'd have preferred Archie Gemmell against Holland in 1978, no?
Well, actually, yeah, similar to that. But, I mean, he just weaved through several bodies to do that, to have the sort of presence of mind, the ability to do that. Going through the smallest of gaps, it was extraordinary. And even if Cavendish had followed him, he might not, well, Cavendish is very skilled as well, but he might not have been able to get through the same gaps because they might have closed after Sagan passed. So, phenomenal finish by Sagan, phenomenal, and fantastic by Cavendish as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was a split second. It was obviously a split second decision whether or not to follow Blythe, and perhaps, you know, the fact they haven't ridden together a lot, it's not his usual lead out man, dictated that Cavendish preferred to follow Sagan. But I think possibly Blythe went a tiny fraction of a second too early. But having said that, I think it probably would have been the better option to follow Blythe. And I think that the unusual thing about this sprint was that at that point, Cavendish found himself, you know, usually at 200 metres, 250 metres to go, there might be four or five riders ahead of him, but of those four or five riders, two or three would be lead-out men. In this instance, there were five or six guys all sprinting effectively for the line, and that meant the road was very much taken up by, you know, a lot of riders moving very quickly, and it was simply difficult to find a spot, to find a gap, and he ended up behind Michael Matthews and lost momentum, and that was probably the difference between him winning and losing.
Eurosport, the home of cycling.
Thank you very much to Eurosport for sponsoring the cycling podcast. Coming up on Eurosport, starting on Tuesday the 25th of October, the London 6 Day, second running of the revived London 6 Day, and it will of course feature Mark Cavendish and man of the moment Bradley Wiggins. So that'll be interesting, won't it? We'll be there, Lionel.
Looking forward to it, yeah. Be there for at least two or three days, yeah.
Let's carry on with the world, shall we? I think you had a few more remarks on the World Championships.
Well, Rich, your comment, I think, on Twitter on Sunday afternoon summed up Peter Sagan's victory.
Thank you very much, Lionel. The best
bike rider in the world is the world champion again. And they're all the more impressive for winning on a completely different course against the best sprinters, or some of the best sprinters. Obviously, when it comes down to a race to the line like that, there's a little bit of luck that comes into play. That Daniel, as you said, those split second decisions, you know, Mark Cavendish has presumably been replaying it in his head over and over since Sunday, thinking about what he might have done differently. But you know, you only get one go at it, and I think that's what's so impressive about Sagan's victory. But on the other hand, you know, as the defending champion, in a way, of all of them, he had least to lose. He wasn't the outstanding favourite for it, but he found himself in that position. He knew everyone would be watching him, but could just afford to do his thing. And as you say, Rich, he steered himself through there, you know, with, you know, remarkable skill.
He's been very clinical this year, hasn't he? And that was the thing that was missing. He's added it to his armoury as world champion. Ironically, they often say the curse of the rainbow jersey can sort of paralyse people and make it more difficult to win. He's found it easier to win in the rainbow jersey. It seems to have, you know, certainly led to him being a bit more clinical in his finishing.
Just a few other things from the riders who finished in the leading places. The Italians really cocked it up, didn't they, Daniel? I mean, I was surprised that Viviani wasn't the man that they were protecting at the end. Giacomo Nizzolo was their best-placed finisher in fifth place. Any indication of what the fallout was after the race with the Italians?
Well, they were actually pretty pleased with the way things went. You know, they decided Nizzolo was going to be the faster guy, and, you know, they rode a pretty good race. Bernardi was one of the stars of the race, certainly did a lot of work on the front. And I mean, it's not a team of the highest quality. You know, Viviani and Nizzolo are both, I would say, a notch beneath the best sprinters in the world, certainly over that distance, over such a long race. So there are always recriminations in the Italian camp in the days and weeks and often months that follow World Championships. But in this case, they were pretty sanguine about the whole thing, certainly compared to the French.
And what about the Norwegians as well? I mean, they had two very strong riders in the final group. Alexander Kristoff, pretty upset with Edvald Bosenhagen at the finish. I mean, I've said this before on the podcast, but when you're a team and you have riders who finish sixth and seventh, you know, basically they were followed each other over the line, or followed one another over the line, you know, that indicates that they made a mess of things. And Kristoff certainly felt that Bosenhagen should perhaps have done more to help him. Maybe Bosenhagen.
Bosenhagen has been accused of this before when he was at Sky, of riding for himself a little bit at the same time. Or on the other hand, he was instrumental in helping Mark Cavendish win at least one stage in at the Tour de France in 2012. I remember, trying to remember then, the stage into Brive just before Paris. Bosenhagen rode an absolute blinder that day, but it's difficult, isn't it? I mean, they ride for different teams. There'd no doubt have been a cash bonus to Bosenhagen to help Kristoff, but really, this is where you have a problem, isn't it? When you've got two riders, both really from a group like that, capable of winning, you know, both capable of winning, perhaps too evenly matched to ask one of them to give up his chances for the other one.
Yeah, and of course, Bosenhagen had a trade teammate in there with a very good chance of winning, Mark Cavendish. I'm not suggesting for a second that he helped Cavendish, because if he did do that, which I don't think he did, he certainly did a pretty poor job of it, because he played no role. He had no real effect in helping Cavendish. And yeah, I mean, not a good result for them at all. I mean, just going back to the race itself, Rich, I mean, it was... There was an exciting part of the race, you know, certainly in the first hour and a half. But I think maybe some of the criticism that we levelled at the whole operation last week was a little bit harsh and a little bit severe. But, you know, I think it has to go down as a pretty disappointing World Championships, purely on that one criteria, the lack of local support. You know, I thought that possibly when it came to the men's road race on the Sunday, that's when everyone would come out, and that's when... whatever advertising the organisers have done locally would pay dividends. And it wasn't really much better than any of the other days, was it? I know Peter Sagan said that, yeah, everyone could watch on TV, and they did, and we did, and it was a different kind of spectacle. And certainly the part out in the desert was novel and intriguing. But I think it will go down as a fairly disappointing World Championships. You guys agree?
I would agree. I mean, in terms of determining the best winner, I don't think you can complain. In terms of offering a different challenge, and I think we had an email in from one of our listeners, Imad Nasser Khan, who lives out in the region, and he was a little bit miffed at our criticism. And he made the points that, you know, as the World Championships, you know, it's only right that the riders are presented with different types of challenges, and this certainly was a different type of challenge. You know, why not every so often have a World Championships that's held in very warm conditions that maybe isn't conducive to the European riders? Why not have it on a completely flat course where the crosswinds are the big unknown factor? And in that case, you know, you can't really argue with having a different challenge for the World Championships. But by the same token, you know, we've never had a sort of a mountaintop finish for the World Championships. I mean, if we're going to have one extreme, then perhaps there should be the other.
Yeah, the email I mentioned earlier came from Imad Nasser Khan, who doesn't actually live in Qatar, but has done in the past. I think he still lives in the Middle East. And yeah, he said that there was, in our discussion, there was an underlying bias that seems to suggest a right of Europeans who dominate the sport to have hospitable conditions in which to ride. And maybe he doesn't say it, but maybe also a bias that the championships should be held in Europe every year. And I don't think we'd agree with that. I think I think the main focus, certainly in my criticism, was the lack of spectators, because I think the spectators always add a lot to the spectacle. So that was a shame. But the racing itself was, you know, it had its appeal, and the desert as a backdrop also has an appeal. It was quite, especially there was a moment where a sort of tornado blew up, if that's what you call it, and blew in front of the riders, and that was pretty spectacular. And it certainly was, you know, as a visual treat, there was something there, but I don't think we'd want the World Championships to be held there every year. I think would be the conclusion from it all.
Well, nobody's suggesting that, fortunately.
Nobody's suggesting that. Can I just say, on the Women's World Championship, we're not really discussing that. We're saving that for the next cycling podcast, Femina, which I'm actually recording tomorrow. That's Wednesday in London with Orla Shinoui, and we're going to be joined by Bob Varney, who is out there. He runs the drops team. And we'll maybe hear from one of the riders as well. And that will be coming out early next week, and that will cover the women's side of things in some detail at some length.
But it was a stunning victory, wasn't it, for the Danish rider, Dideriksen. Back to the men's, just wrap up on the men's race. Have to mention William Bonnet, French rider, who finished eighth. And he was one of the riders who came off worst in that horrendous crash on the Tour de France early stage to Huy in 2015, and there was a lot of talk that maybe Bonnet wouldn't come back from that. It's been a long road back for him, and impressive that he was up there at the finish.
Chapeau to Bonnet.
Oh, very good, Rich, very good.
Hey, you like that? Tour de France. Ah, that joke reached Berlin at last. There, I saw Daniel's chest heave. Listen, Tour de France route this morning. What are your thoughts? What are your thoughts on that? It's a kind of, has he been inspired by the Vuelta, perhaps, with all these kind of steep and unknown mountains? Old friend of the podcast, Prudy.
The most gimmicky thing, and there is a bit of gimmickry in there, is the fact that I think for the first time ever, there's going to be a bit of Alps, a mouthful of Alps, and then they're going to go over to the Pyrenees and then more Alps towards the end. So effectively splitting up the two major mountain ranges. You're also visiting the five major mountain ranges of France for the first time. So the Vosges, the Jura, the Alps, the Pyrenees, and the Massif Central. And, you know, not a lot of, perhaps not a lot of the really iconic climbs, the Galibiers in there, but not too many others. And some short stages, there's a mountainous 100-kilometer stage, which will be interesting in the Pyrenees. Some very steep climbs. There is a section on the Grand Colombier, which is supposedly the steepest section of D road in France, about 400,000 kilometers of D road in France off the top of my head, and that there is about 100 meter stretch or 200 meter stretch on that climb. It's the steepest D road in France, supposedly. And the Mont du Chat is supposedly the longest climb in France with an average gradient of over 9%. So, and only used once before in the Tour in 1974 when Raymond Poulidor dropped Eddy Merckx famously. But as overall, Rich, haven't really got a handle yet on who it's likely to suit. Maybe because the Tour route never really suits any rider in particular. It always just suits the best rider, doesn't it? I mean, I think Lionel would probably agree with that.
No? It's a climber's route, says Chris Froome. It's not necessarily a climber's route, says Richie Port. Lionel is talking about staying in the Alps for the 10-day period while the tour goes over the Pyrenees and works its way back again. You're talking about just staying in Chambéry, aren't you, Lionel?
Yeah, wait for it. Have a 10-day break and wait for it. We can do this on Skype, Rich. You can head off and I'll have a little training camp in mid-July.
Yeah.
I don't think I'm not going to get that. That's not going to happen, is it? No.
Let the mountain come to Muhammad or something. What's that, Daniel?
Has anyone dubbed it the boomerang tour yet?
They have.
You
now.
Just have, yeah. It's interesting though, isn't it? You know, the route itself, it's a very unusual shape. It doesn't. It's about as far from going around the hexagon as you can get. Obviously, starts in Dusseldorf, which I probably should have known this, but Dusseldorf, I found out today because it was mentioned in the presentation. It's the home of Kraftwerk, the band that composed the iconic tune Tour de France, which anyone who watched Channel 4's coverage in the 80s, they used to use it for their kind of review of the week montages, didn't they, on their tour coverage. It's a cliche to go on about where we're going food-wise, but I'm very much looking forward to a night in Foix, down in the southwest, home of Cassoulet. Less looking forward to a night in Troyes, which is in the east of France, where Adam Yates was an amateur rider, riding for a French club there. But that's the home
a lot of British riders being in Troyes.
Malcolm Elliott was there.
Robert Miller lived there for many years.
That's the home of Andouillette, the horrible sausage.
You said Foix is the home of Cassoulet, isn't it? Castel Nordry.
Well, this is a question of dispute here. Foix and Castel Nordry are the two homes of Cassoulet, I guess, and they both have very slightly different recipes. There's a lot of dispute about which recipe is the definitive, but Foix, certainly you'll get a good Cassoulet there. Troyes, you'll get a terrible Andouillette there, which is
nice champagne though.
Lovely champagne, yeah. The stage Troyes, I'm looking forward to.
Troyes right on the edge of champagne.
Come all right, on. All right.
The stage I'm looking forward to is the one from Périgueux to Bergerac, because the scenery there will be absolutely stunning through the Dordogne there, past all the.
Foie gras country, that is. Foie gras. Not a fan of foie gras personally, but
the Salad de Gésier as well, if you like sort of bird's neck meat, that's always a favourite.
I think foie gras crosses an ethical line, doesn't it? Like Team Sky crosses an ethical line. Do you need a TUE for it?
It's
wine in Huy Saint-Georges in Burgundy as well. Some fantastic water in Vittel. Oh, it's a gastronomic delight, this Tour de France.
It is. Just on the ethics of foie gras, I agree with you, but it is within the law, unlike the Ortolan bird.
It's also delicious.
Which is banned, you know, the one that they soak in, I think, Armagnac, is it? And then
that's definitely crossing the line. Yeah, that's the sort of stuff Armstrong used to eat, whereas Team Sky just stick to foie gras.
But what about the race? I mean, the thing that strikes me as interesting is how early the climb to La Planche des Belles Filles is. It's on the first Wednesday after three sprint stages, although the one of those has got a little hill before the finish, I believe. But the La Planche des Belles Filles, been in the Tour twice before. In 2012, of course, Chris Froome won there just ahead of Bradley Wiggins, and that was where Wiggins took the yellow jersey for the first time. And then it returned in 2014, and Vincenzo Nibali, the eventual winner of the Tour, won the stage. So it's, although it's early and it will be the only major climb of that day, I assume, it could really set the pattern for the race. It will certainly shake things up very early on. Quite an interesting one if they're, you know, the whole business of the Tour is to try to suspend, you know, ensure that suspense lasts till the end. It seems unusual to put a big climb like that in right in the middle of the first week.
Yeah, and I think it's part of the welterification of the Tour de France, isn't it? You know, shorter climbs possibly playing a key role, and climbs coming earlier, shorter stages. I mean, we've seen this over the last 4 or 5 years now, and also not quite so many summit finishes. I think that's a definite trend now, away from the real glut of summit finishes that we maybe saw a few years ago. And the tour organizers at the time thought that was one way to guarantee entertainment, and I think increasingly over the last few years we've seen more interesting stages in mountain stages that haven't finished on top of mountains. And I think the Stage de Chambéry certainly stands out, with the Mont du Chat as potentially a real cracker, and also the Stage de Foix. I mean, people again will perhaps turn their nose up at the fact that we're not finishing maybe on top of the Mur de Pégur, which wouldn't be possible logistically anyway, but I think that one will be a real cracker, and very short as well, 100 kilometres.
And of course, in the final week, there is one of the big beasts of the Alps, the Col d'Izoard, which is very difficult, 2,300 metres, I think, at the top. And the fact that they're finishing on top of that will be it will make it completely different to a stage where they maybe would go over it and finish in. Normally they would finish in Briançon, or certainly several times they finished in Briançon.
This will also be the scene of the new La Course, which is moving from Paris again. As I mentioned earlier, we'll talk about that properly in the cycling podcast Femina, whether that's a good thing or not a good thing, that the women's race, which had been rumoured to maybe extend over several days, it's still only going to be a single day, and it will be a very short 60-kilometre, I think, mountain stage rather than a crit in Paris. Maybe that's progress, maybe it isn't. We'll discuss that properly in the cycling podcast Femina.
And then the final battleground will be this time trial in Marseille, starting in the Stade Vélodrome, the home of Olympique Marseille, which used to be a velodrome way back when. It's been redeveloped significantly recently for the European Championships last summer.
Hometown. Forward to an evening out with François Thomazeau,
exactly.
In Marseille, is where he lives.
The home of Monsieur No Bullshit. Francois Tomazo. I did hear, I haven't had a detailed look at the time trial course, but it looks like it hugs the Corniche and then darts inland to go up quite a steep climb before heading over the top and back down to the Stade Velodrome. Unlikely that the tour will all hinge on that, but it's certainly, you know, if there is anything to play for towards the end, you know, it could be spectacular. It'll certainly look spectacular, won't it, down there in Marseille?
Look how Daniel holds his microphone with his pinky sticking out like that. Like, very much, you can take the man out of England, can't you? But very home county, sort of drink a cup of tea, look about you there, Daniel.
Don't drink tea. Anyway, go on.
Yes, you don't.
Should explain that we're watching Daniel on Skype. We've got it. We've got him in vision here, just to, so we, when he wants to make a point, he can. Is that what he's
stick
indicating?
His pinky out. Is that what the pinky means, or is that just an affectation?
No, that's not that. Carry on, chaps. Just but, ignore me.
I mean, it's a long way away, the Tour de France, but just looking at it at very first glance, you know,
who's going to win?
I mean, this is the sort of speculation I love.
Roman Bardet.
I think. Well, that was the point I was going to make. I do think that it's nicely balanced, and Christian Prudhomme made the point that descending is as much a factor as climbing, almost, and that's something that we've seen more of in recent years of the Tour de France. And if that's the case, it certainly won't hurt Roman Bardet, who is one of the best at going downhill very quickly.
Put your money on him now. It's virtually certain.
I might do. My World Championship bets all went south, so I may well do.
Whoever you are, wherever you ride, whatever the reason, Rafa exists to improve your ride with the finest kit, inspiring stories and vibrant clubhouses and communities all over the world.
Thank you very much to Rafa for sponsoring the cycling podcast. Their support is very much appreciated. Thank you to them. Now, thank you also to Mark Devaney from MD Flooring Solutions Limited, a friend of the podcast, who has very kindly offered four tickets, two pairs of tickets, for the forthcoming Ruler Classic, which is the first weekend in November. And these are tickets for the Saturday session, which features, among other people, Sean Kelly, Javier Guillen, the Vuelta España director, Graham O'Brien will be there, Laura Trott, Jason Kenny. Orla Shinui will be one of the hosts as well. So that should be a fun day. It is a daytime session. I think it goes up to about 4 o'clock, 4:30. If you'd like to win these tickets, as I say, there are two pairs, please email us, contact@thecyclingpodcast.com, and just tell us why you would like to go. The best responses will win the tickets and be read out in next week's podcast.
Yeah, keep it brief. We're not after an essay. We don't want 1,000 words, but just a sentence or two.
100 words max.
100 words max, there we go. Sentence or two, why do you want to go? And we'll pick the best slash funniest.
It's happening in London, of course. It was held last year. Lots of stars there. It was a good event, and it's being held again this year. So, fellas, in this final part, we turn once again for the third time, I think, to the ongoing, I suppose, the follow-up to our interview with Dave Brailsford. As we said earlier, lots of reaction to that. I'll maybe read out a bit of an email that we got from somebody expressing maybe a slightly alternative view. Always interesting to get alternative views. But overwhelmingly, the reaction has been negative, in the sense that people don't really feel that Dave Brailsford clarified an awful lot in our interview. We asked him certainly all the things. I think there were three key areas. There was Bradley Wiggins' TUEs for triamcinolone. There was the alleged use of tramadol on Team Sky. And there was the mystery over the package that was taken out to the Dauphiné in 2011. And really, I think there were... I read him out a little passage from my book, Sky's the Limit, where he talked at the end of 2010 about the line and where it is. And I think we can sort of look back and conclude, and I think he admitted it, that certainly policies were changed slightly towards the end of 2010, going into the 2011 season. And, you know, even since our interview with Dave Brailsford, Chris Froome has come out with something fairly strong in cycling news, saying he didn't know about Bradley Wiggins' TUEs. And Mark Cavendish as well has spoken a little bit about it. And Brian Cookson also has said that he thinks that... Team Sky were pushing right up against the line of legality, which is probably a very uncomfortable thing for him to admit. He's the UCI president now, but at the time he was president of British Cycling, and you know, on the board at Team Sky. So very, very uncomfortable times. I think Dave Brills was very uncomfortable throughout our interview. Daniel, what was your reaction to it?
Well, I think I can understand why people weren't satisfied with a lot of the answers. I think some of it is, rather than Dave Brills being devious or nefarious, I think it's just his communication style. And, you know, he wants to give exhaustive explanations to everything. And then sometimes he forgets what he wanted to say in the first place, or forgets what the question was in the first place. And, you know, there was a lack of commitment to certain things. For example, you know, the question that I put to him through you guys about the MPCC, he said that no, he didn't want to join the MPCC because he had other policy disagreements with them. That, well, you know, the point that I was trying to make was this not the time just to suck up whatever those disagreements are, just for the sake of, in particular, the cortisol testing? And you know, and if Sky wants to have a more rigorous policy on zero tolerance in terms of employing people, rather than a policy of not employing people that have had a six month and longer ban, then well, that's fine. But at least, you know, take on the rules that are useful and are important to them and their fans. And you know, he said, okay, it's something we might think about, the cortisol testing, in future, but it's something that he needs to do now, and it's something that they need to make a commitment to now. And you know, similarly about there was a lot of not passing the buck, but a lot of sort of putting responsibility very much on the shoulders of his doctors, and talking about, well, you know, he couldn't judge whether this was a sledgehammer to kill an ant. The treatment that Wiggins underwent with his TUE, well, you know, there are also questions about their recruitment policy, Sky's recruitment policy as far as medical staff are concerned. Let's not forget, this is the team that hired Gert Lenders, which to my mind still remains the worst thing they've done and the most negligent thing they've done in their history. Gert Lenders being the Belgian Rabobank doctor who, I think we can say with, well, some certainty now, did administer doping products in his time at Rabobank in the early part of the last decade and mid part of the last decade. So yeah, there was a fair amount that was disappointing. Also the issue of the Jiffy bag, and you know, I mean, you guys got some criticism for not pressing him harder on certain things. And I think, you know, the thing that we discussed certainly over the weekend was that, you know, I think it's been our policy generally to give people enough rope to either hang themselves or pull themselves out of the mire. And you know, I think people will make their own mind up and have made their own mind up based on Dave Brailsford's answers to those questions. I don't think it really needs our moral judgment necessarily. If people are interested in what we thought, then you know, I suppose I've just given what my view was, that it was fairly unsatisfactory. Without it being deliberate obfuscation, I don't necessarily believe that, you know, he's trying to mislead or deceive people. But unsatisfactory.
There are things he can't really, even if mistakes have been made, he can't really admit to them, you know, because to do so would be to cast a shadow over one of the team's defining successes, which is the 2012 Tour de France for Bradley Wiggins.
And yet that shadow undoubtedly exists. You know, that's what was so frustrating about this, was that it's almost like they're refusing to accept that all of the media coverage that there has been, some of which has been you know, a little bit unfair, but the fact that it's rumbled on now for a month, that means that the shadow is quite long and dark over Bradley Wiggins' Tour victory. And, you know, this was an opportunity to shed a bit of light. And whether it was waffle or whether it was filibustering, I'm not entirely sure. It felt like we weren't going to get sort of straight answers to straight questions. And I think that at this point, Team Sky and Dave Brailsford, you know, really they needed to have offered some much straighter answers
I think they did. You know, Brian Cookson is right. I mean, Travis Tygart has said the same thing, that what we're talking about here is potentially abuse of the TUE system. It's almost like, you know, the whole doping has progressed, if we can use that word, or morphed into something different, which is not smuggling in, you know, blood bags and EPO, but doing things that you can probably justify to yourself as being within the rules, even if they perhaps aren't actually within the rules, if the rules were to be applied properly. Can I just read out a bit of an email that we received from a listener, James McKenzie? We've had a lot of emails. I've had some emails from some real Sky fans who have, you know, said in the emails that they've been getting abuse on Twitter and things like that. And I think that's one of the very unfortunate things. These people did not write TUEs for Bradley Wiggins. You know, they follow Team Sky in good faith and they don't deserve to be abused. But we got an email from somebody, James McKenzie, who wrote, "I do get a sense that we're losing our perspective. The use of EPO, HGH, steroids, blood doping sits at one end of the spectrum and is very clearly wrong. On the other end is bread and water riding, where you do nothing to enhance your performance apart from riding your bike and eating food. In between is where we get into the grey areas, because this is where medicines can be used for legitimate medical reasons. We ask and expect WADA and UCI to be the guardians of this ethical line to distinguish between what is legitimate and what is gaming of the system. If we suspect that widespread gaming of the system is taking place, then the system needs to be changed to prevent this." Quite interesting points, I thought. Any more to add, Daniel?
Yeah, and you mentioned Armstrong there, Rich, and I think that's one of the ways in which the Armstrong saga has really influenced this whole story. And another way is, I think Dave Brailsford is, you know, they've chosen a strategy whereby they're trying to explain, and in a very long-winded fashion. And, you know, that's also why they got himself into trouble with why they got themselves into trouble with the Emma Pooley issue, that he was contacted by a journalist, and rather than just deny or stonewall or say no comment, and there was a will there to try and give some kind of explanation. Whereas, you know, once upon a time, Armstrong in particular would come into a press conference, he'd bang his fist on the table and say, "No, you're wrong, and I will sue you." And I think Sky are desperate not to do that, and they know that they can't do that because they know how bad it will look. But in their efforts not to do that and to adopt a different tack, I think sometimes they have come across as waffly and
they have allowed certain, you know, ideas to gain real momentum over many years. This has been a policy from the start, you know, that determination not to follow the Armstrong example has led them to take a very relaxed attitude to some of the criticism that's been levelled at them right from not from day one, but from the moment they started winning.
Yeah, and not to have a very aggressive, I mean, some would argue that they have been quite aggressive in terms of their PR, but I would suggest that when it's come to, you know, shooting down rumours or shooting down debate, or often they have entertained that to a large degree, and it has in some cases festered and grown and taken on a life of its own, and put them in quite a difficult spot.
Well, they remain in that difficult spot, and I'm sure we'll return to this. As I say, I think it's still got quite a bit of mileage in it, this story. It will rumble on, and as we say, I don't think the consensus is that Dave Brailsford has certainly not put it to bed with his interview with us. In some ways made it worse, but we'll see. And I think that the best hope for Team Sky and Dave Brailsford is that this UK anti-doping investigation progresses very quickly. I think that there are a lot of conversations going on about that, particularly maybe looking at the role of Dr. Richard Freeman. So the best hope is that does progress very quickly and comes to some kind of conclusion, one way or the other, quickly. Anyway, for the moment, Daniel, thank you very much.
Thank you, chaps.
Thank you, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard. See you next week at the London Six.
Become a friend of the podcast for 2016. For £10, you'll have access to our Friends Specials, 11 in-depth episodes that will take you even further inside the sport. All our Friends Specials are now available on your mobile device. Our 2015 Friends Specials are also still available for £5. To sign up, visit www.thecyclingpodcast.com.